schmettern die hellen Fanfaren. Vorwärts, vorwärts, Jugend kennt keine Gefahren. Deutschland, du wirst leuchtend stehen, mögen wir auch untergehen. Vorwärts, vorwärts, schmettern die hellen Fanfaren. Vorwärts, vorwärts, Jugend kennt keine Gefahren. Ist das Ziel auch noch so hoch? Jugend zwingt es doch.
Unsere Fahne flattert uns voran. In die Zukunft sehen wir Hand für Hand. Wir marschieren, wir gehen da durch Nacht und durch Mut. Mit der Fahne der Jugend für Freiheit und Mut. Unsere Fahne flattert uns voran. Unsere Fahne ist die neue Zeit. Und die Fahne für uns.
So, g'day everyone. This is my first time on the podcast. Just thought I'd give my two cents about a topic which I'm fairly familiar with. So this talk will be covering why nativism, directed mostly to the burnt out or ex-National Socialist. It may also interest people in the general nationalist sphere who are interested in the discussion between the ideas. In this talk, the term National Socialism, or henceforth NS, will refer explicitly to the 1919 to 1945 German conception of it, as well as its more modern adherents. While this is not intended to be an adversarial talk, it is important to mention at the beginning that the Natives Association is not a National Socialist one, according to the previous definition. We hold to a national conception of the Australian people and land, which for us also includes social principles and the responsibilities to those people. But we don't tie ourselves to any government, current or historical, outside of Australia. I'm speaking here now as someone who was, years ago, heavily involved in NS. I'll keep the details on that sparse for now. There is much that can be said on this topic, but I've decided to keep it somewhat short so that it is somewhat digestible. If you have moved on from NS but still care deeply about your people and culture, listen on. So NS is supposed to be a benefit. While there are some political advantages to putting forth this system, there is also lots of baggage with NS. The conversation is framed so that you have to deny, minimize, or agree with, and look terrible, the worst things that have happened in a century. This constantly puts us on the back foot. Acting in an antagonistic way here both doesn't suit most people and doesn't work on most people. It is always easier to talk to people about positive things if you can at all help it. And yes, I am very familiar with lemming theory and its associated ideas, but the most here also involves potential activists. I could go on here, but we'll leave it there for now. Some examples of the baggage that I'm talking about includes killings of the disabled, brutal slave labor, splitting hairs on Lebensraum and what that meant. Instead of having to argue these points, you can just not do that. Australian history and nationalism has a wide range of points to draw on without having that kind of association. We have our bright spots, and most people have a far less of a strong reaction to our own history than, well, you know, H-Man is secularist Satan, pretty much. As a brief aside, I might cop some flack for this in some nationalist circles, but we have historically treated Aboriginals very poorly. Of course, we've now gone too far in the other direction, practically to the point of worship in some circles. But from the time of colonization until the 1970s or so, the Aboriginals definitely had a rough go of it. Even in today's Australia, with their immense advantages, they are still living on conquered land, a small and weak minority, and their blood thinned out to the point of absurdity in many cases. The Aboriginal issue is one thorny topic that we can't avoid, and as nationalists, we have to have a good argument for it. However, we can't avoid it anyway. Whether or not you're a National Socialist, nativist, or even a four-year-old in preschool, it gets used as a racial battering ram against us as white people every day. It's best to have the smallest possible defensive position while defending as much as possible. For example, if you're defending a room, you guard the door. Key points should be defended, and others should be disregarded or even ridiculed. as if they were trying to walk into your room via the wall. In other words, talking about the Aboriginal issue is complicated enough. There's no need to discuss, for example, the locations of camps in German-occupied Europe. Let me come at this from another angle. When arguing for monarchy or traditionalism, for example, does anyone feel the need to defend Genghis Khan? A great, but extremely brutal mass murderer, indirectly responsible for the deaths of perhaps tens of millions of people between his and his descendants' conquests. Of course not. He should be seen as essentially irrelevant to the question of monarchy. Monarchy as a system and idea is defensible without absurdity, unless you are talking to an absurd person. Likewise, nationalism as a system and idea is defensible without arguing till you're blue in the face about specific parts of World War II. These parts are irrelevant to nationalism. So next we have the non-organic nature of NS movements. So NS has quite a slick and to some appealing propaganda structure. It's quite easy to make NS look cool. There are two main reasons for this. The first one, to be fair, is that a lot of work has been done in the last few decades to tie in hardcore NS to masculinity and strength. For every stereotypical anime Nazi with thigh-high socks on Twitter, there's many more who have tried to adopt the worldview as best they can and to become men of worth. I'll return to this point later, but until then, let's call it fair enough. The second reason is that the modern NS movement worldwide is to a large extent coasting off the backs of not only the 1919 to 1945 NSDAP, but all the wartime and post-war propaganda. The post-war propaganda in particular has tried to make the Nazis out to be all sorts of things, but the ones that have stuck are generally these. Evil, yes, but strong, intelligent, stylish, and dangerous to the Western liberal order. Now, this is propaganda that your enemies have made up for you. In making the attempt to smear anyone against progress as a Nazi, the liberal propagandists have, to some extent, created their own enemy. If you're generally liberal in outlook but get called a Nazi by rabid leftists or the media, or even friends or family, well, that's caused a lot of people to look into that worldview, including myself at one point. To return to that previous point now about NS being tied to masculinity and strength, it need not be like that. NS was, of course, defeated by other men of strength. Now, it could be said that other nations were coasting on better times and only won due to a strong material advantage, though I disagree with some of the specifics. I think it's fair to say that the sheer grit and determination of the Slavs, even under a retarded political and economic system, is to be admired. They didn't have NS, and they still had strength. There is no monopoly on strength as a concept within National Socialism. So why nativism? Well, nativism is another word for national, but for us, it is specifically tailored to the Australian context. While the term can be used in any country, it implies nation and people first, more so than nationalism, which has recently become much more amorphous. And in these circles, usually refers to the global struggle against admittedly common enemies. So nativism is, for us, a stronger focus on our roots and what makes us a nation. It would be true to say that most people, including nationalists, don't know much about our history and culture. But isn't that a great cause of our misery? If people were made more aware of our past and our claim to the land, wouldn't the national cause be made easier? Put aside the telegram edits of Sunwheel George Washington and the laser-eyed Codrianu, embrace our own forefathers. They would have labelled our current government as traitors. A retort to this could be that we should associate with the tree and not the branch of our people. And I think that this is the mark of deracination. Who primarily identifies as black or Asian? Well, African and Asian Americans who have nothing else. It's obvious that we have been subjected to deracination. This isn't a criticism of Europeans or of anyone listening. But the logical conclusion to this idea is that some kind of worship or reverence for our proto-Indo-European ancestors and chariots, drinking milk and conquering the steppe. But people do believe this. And in honesty, you have very little in common with those ancestors compared with your great-great-great-grandfathers. At least you speak the same language. Now, to resume to my earlier point on nativism, Years ago, I remember seeing a quote from Sir Oswald Mosley about how Australia didn't need fascism because we already were a fascist country. I did try and find that quote for the podcast with no success. So while it might not be authentic, it does sound plausible that he would say it. Either way, while Australia being fascist was also not exactly true, you have to think of all that Australia was, where we were going, and what we were doing around the 1930s. There haven't been many fash wave gifts of Edmund Barton made, but that doesn't stop the idea that Australia was on the right path. We've become a working man's paradise. We had traditional values, a strong sense of racial pride. We were masters of the continent and constantly growing. We had peace and stability. Beyond a very few small-scale guerrilla conflicts and revolts, we've been incredibly lucky to avoid war on our home soil so far. Now, this is somewhat of a basic point, but it bears saying that NS and fascism as ideas become more popular in the bad times, and this is a mark of desperation. This should then be no criticism of our ancestors in Australia. Things weren't bad enough to go down that route. In that sense, you could see nativism as a desire to return to the good times, or close to them, rather than a completely new thing in our context. Now, it is true. We have long since left these good times, and that the only thing that really remains is our great material wealth, especially in the hands of those who might otherwise be our strongest supporters. For example, skilled tradesmen, miners, lower professional classes, the most prominent examples. But these restrictions also exist for NS. It's a sad reality that people will not be mobilized until things have gotten bad economically. Right now, our cost of living crisis is mostly reducing the ability of the wealthy to go out for dinner more than twice a week, more so than a meaningful reduction in the quality of life in comparison to, say, the Great Depression. So here are some criticisms of nativism from an NS point of view. So one of them is that nativism in comparison to NS is just a bit lame. Now, in a way, this is true. It does seem a bit kitschy, at least to me personally, but in a way that all national history and feeling has been. So even in the 1930s, romanticism and traditionalism were often seen that way, even from the right. However, to a large extent, this is just a psyop by your enemies to turn you away from your own people and history. Disconnection from your heritage makes you easier to control and attack. It just means we need to either work harder to reclaim the old or to find new ways of presenting it in ways relevant and attractive to people. And how could a revival work in any other way? In fairness, you don't see NS types walking around in period-accurate brown shirts anymore. I believe the term is closer to nipster black bloc. So one could argue against this and say something totally new must arise. Sure, but then we're not talking about NS anymore, since that's even more played out than strictly Australian nationalism. It's become so vogue that it has taken over most of the conceptual scene in Australia. It has, in a sense, become the mainstream and isn't really something new. NS and aligned movements have been in Australia since around the 1960s. There's arguments for and against this kind of something new, but this discussion is outside of the scope of this episode. Now, is nativism needlessly parochial? Perhaps. Parochial is another term that has been slandered. It originated in referring to a parish, which for most people in Christian Europe was, until recently, perhaps the most important day-to-day distinction in someone's life. You can certainly be too parochial. We aren't trying to run a bake sale to fix old Betty's roof, after all. There are grander goals for a group of industrious and patriotic men to achieve. It would instead be more accurate to say that our vision is not focused as wide as it can go in the material world, that is, the whole of Earth. Nationalists in general have historically cared for a very wide set of people, places, and ideas, wider than most ideologies and systems. In the old days, before nationalism as a modern ideology was born, the village past your neighbour's village may not have crossed people's minds much at all. And yet, Australian nativists are considered to be small-minded because we place our concern for first and foremost with a land of tens of millions, approximately 7.7 million square kilometres in size. This is, frankly, a ridiculous idea. No, we focus on our land first and foremost, where it belongs. We still care about other nations, especially other Western nations sharing our blood, religion, and cultures. But we look at home, with our own history and our own potential, as the most subject of interest. You can fantasize about living in Europe or in America, and if so, we can hardly stop you from moving there. But most of you won't do that. Might I suggest keeping your mind in the country that you actually inhabit? Our strengths are as strong and our problems as pressing as any other country. And finally, is nativism inactive? Well, no, but it's not active in the sense of trying to get into the news every month. This is more of an organizational approach. We seek coverage on our grounds and on our schedule. Again, I don't seek to disparage any particular group, but to seek constant coverage is to become a dancing monkey for the media, all according to their tune. We have our own timeline and our own goals. Speaking purely personally here, I personally would like this timeline accelerated, given the immense scope of our problems, the most obvious and pressing being the racial tsunami we are currently facing, and a faster response would certainly be appropriate. However, we need your help for that. I need help from every friend listening. We need to collectivize, collaborate, and start making some real progress in saving our people. We simply can't afford to be as completely ineffective as our ideological predecessors were. So in short, nativism is about focusing on your land and your people first and foremost. You live here. NS argued and stood for things that our own history and people had. But luckily, we were able to avoid most conflict, dictatorship, and other baggage to get them. And we should be proud of that. The Holocaust and other baggage are not a restriction to arguing for the welfare of your own people. Given the nature of the Holocaust as a post-war liberal foundational myth, it is inevitable that it be brought up, and we can talk about it, but we don't need to obsess over it. So that's all from me. I'm going to let Nikolai and Michael ask their questions now, or their own things that they need to talk about. I'll leave the floor open.
Yeah, thanks for that, Thomas. So when I was originally thinking about doing this podcast, and it's been kind of a bit more of a talk so far, I thought though we could discuss more of the ideology stuff, how the origin of National Socialism in the trade union movement of the Sudetenland paralleled the origin of the Australian Labor Party, so on. How there was like a lot of similarities in the early economic and social policies of both groups. But basically, you told me that a lot of contemporary NS guys just wouldn't care about any of that sort of stuff. So would you say it's true that NS is becoming more and more just about sort of optics, you know, the rotating swastikas, baiting the media? Or if that's not the case, why do you think that NatSox just don't care about the historical and ideological stuff, or at least most of them?
Well, look, that's a very complicated question. And I think there's a few different ways of answering that. The simplest, most straightforward one, which is not doing it justice, would be to say that most people just aren't ideological. Even the people who are involved with politics, there's a certain thing or two that they feel very strongly about, and so they join a group and they accept whatever's being said or done. So this is true even for, you know, religious groups or communists who, you know, hold their ideology to be semi-sacred, one could say, in that they're often very upset that people don't read theory, for example. So National Socialists don't feel that same kind of pressure to read theory and to understand history. Obviously, there are some exceptions to that.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good answer. And I think it's something it gets into as well is that a huge part of the background to NS in Germany was, you know, the German Romantic movement, the Furkish movement, or Folkish movement. I guess we don't have to do the gay German pronunciation. So they had like the broader cultural appeal. And I think obviously we're not an NS group in the Natives Association, but we are looking at focusing on the folk culture and all those sorts of things that I think can be more, you say, accessible, like more interesting, I guess, for the average person to go and, you know, listen to some music and maybe hear some poetry or whatever. But it doesn't require, I suppose, the same degree of intellectual work, you know, getting into serious philosophical books and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think, Nikolai?
Look, most people just go off their feelings and their emotions. That's the average modus operandi of everyone. And a lot of people are in general pain about what's going on and they just want to lash out. And they get a reaction by having all the flashy lights and the spinning stars and saying the naughty words. And this reaction makes it feel a little bit better. But it's a little bit like watching a bit of a crude analogy. It's not too dissimilar to watching porn instead of having, you know, relations with a wife, for instance. It's empty. It doesn't achieve anything. And you go back to your bed at night and you fall asleep and it's you wake up the next day, you do it again and nothing is achieved. That's my opinion on it.
Yeah, fair enough. I mean, could be a little harsh on those girls.
someone's got to bring the tough love.
Yeah. I mean, if it is just optics, if it is just the optics, then you could say it kind of is that. And I think, yeah, it is kind of hard to get the substance if you are trying to connect to something that's so far removed from your average experience. Like, if it isn't something that's ideological and it is meant to be cultural. I mean, you're not a German, right? I mean, most people in Australia are not Germans. Nobody in Australia is a proto-Indo-European chariot warrior, as Thomas said. So it is a bit harder to connect to the reality there. I think that might be what Nikolai's point was.
Well, if we also look at the successes of their forebears, were people of rank and capability in organizations. And when they had a thought and a direction, an entire organization ended up moving in that direction. And these, how should I frame this in a slightly more polite way? But they have no real structure that is coherent and going in a particular direction. There's no plan. Anyone I've met from this sort of world isn't an army officer, isn't a police officer, isn't a bureaucrat, isn't a high-ranking businessman. I mean, this was what the early movement was full of. It was, I mean, oh sure, you think of the early days and like the bar and the with the beer and that, it was a bit you know, just the group of the boys. It very quickly became a military organization almost. And no one I've met from this sort of situation actually does the hard work on being on the ground and making an organization with people who are capable, which is why I have that view that I expressed beforehand. And it's a bit of an emotional outcry, a cry for help.
I would personally disagree with that. There are capable people within these organizations. It would be also fair to say that, sure, there are plenty of people that aren't what you're talking about, that aren't army officers, bureaucrats, high up in the police, that sort of thing. Their counter argument to that might be something like, well, you know, these people should join our organization. But I think the takeaway here is that they have no reason to. There's a reason why people aren't joining that group.
Yes.
And it's because it's unappealing.
Yes, exactly. It's
well, it's got a limited appeal. It's not that it's unappealing, because these groups do grow, and they grow, you know, quite quickly. They would have a faster recruitment rate than the natives and so on.
Well, specifically, I'm referring to appealing to you know, high up army officers, like, you know, trying to appeal to a Goering or a, you know, Ludendorff, or, you know, like that's never going to happen in Australia.
Mm.
Yeah, I mean, we're just in such a different context as well.
Completely.
Yeah, that is a part of the angle that I was trying to get to, is that you can't attract those people within the institution. And so to elaborate, when I said capable, I meant, I should have probably said, like, embedded and or high ranking, because you can be a capable person, but not within the regime. not within the system, that gives you experience when it comes to organization. Because like it or not, these people who are in charge have experience of being in charge of large things. They might not be the best at it, and they might hate us, but they have experience doing things that require a lot of technical knowledge. So just elaborate on that.
Yeah. So, you know, the benefit of making a more appealing version, less controversial version of Australian nativism, nationalism in this country has the added benefit of attracting more professionals, people who are more embedded within the system and have more to offer.
Mm.
Yeah. Perhaps we should start going in another track as well, because we've kind of run out of steam on this point. It's a similar point, but a bit more focused in, I suppose, on NS now. But NS as an ideology, or you could say a family of ideologies, because, you know, guys will say every country will have its like its own version suited to it. I mean, actually, that's kind of a point towards nativism almost. But basically, NS as an ideology is often completely conflated, I guess, with the historical actions and ideas of the Austrian painter. There's a lot more history to it, a lot more breadth and variety than that. So I think when we're talking about contemporary NS, are we really just talking about Austrian painterism, or are we actually talking about National Socialism as a real thing? Or is that just a distinction without a difference?
I think that they've broadly become conflated, and that most people who adhere to NS do kind of place the mustache man on this huge pedestal, and that for many, I give him a semi-divine or even entirely divine nature, which is quite peculiar to think about, you know.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's kind of an internal necessity, because as soon as you make this guy indispensable for any form of nationalism anywhere in the Western world, there has to be a justification, because he may be a great historical figure like a Napoleon, like a Lenin for the other side, really any great leader that we can think of that really built up their nation or their empire. He may be equal to that, but if he is really indispensable for everyone, then he has to have some sort of superhuman status. So I think that does have a tendency of moving nationalism away from a political movement and towards a more purely religious sort of cult phenomenon. Would you agree with that? Or
yeah, there's certainly a part of that. And so, you know, again, like some people take that much more seriously than others, but people sort of, as I was saying before earlier on in the podcast, that they act as if everything needs to be defendable, that everything, you know, H-Man did or didn't do needs to be defended. But the thing that I don't really understand is why that actually needs to happen, unless he's some kind of semi-religious figure. You know, he was a man that would get, you know, would enter into flying rages. He occasionally did things that were downright melodramatic, to the point where there were several occasions where he threatened to kill himself. In the end, he did end up doing so for, you know, reasonably justified reasons. You know, he was a mopey and melodramatic man. He perhaps invaded some countries he shouldn't have and whatnot. You can get into it. But even for someone who's very pro H-Man, certain parts of his personality are very hard to idolize in the way that they want him to be. Just partially because so much is known about him. You know, he's someone who, you know, the spotlight of history has been shown on more so than anyone else, and that everyone who has an axe to grind against him will show the worst parts of him to try and make him sound as bad as possible.
I think it is part of this phenomenon of a reactionary approach to sort of nationalist thinking as well, in that if the enemy propaganda, let's say, says, or the liberal propaganda says, you know, this X and Y happened, then it has to be the polar opposite that we're putting forward. So, you know, if the Holocaust is taken as the foundational myth of liberalism or post-war liberalism, as you said, And even as, you know, national conservatives like the Jewish thinker Yoram Hazony, even they'll say, admit that, right, that the Holocaust was sort of foundational to a lot of these post-war policies of civil rights movement in the US and the deconstruction of the White Australia policy in Australia and all those sorts of things. You know, we can admit that without, and we can attack the excess on that side without then having to go all the way to the other extreme and say, you know, it didn't happen, but it should have. And these sort of things that people will come out and say, because, you know, one, because they're trying to gain attention, which, you know, fair enough. Sometimes there could be a time and a place where you might want to grab attention, right? But a lot of people will start to believe it through repetition and so on. So it's kind of danger of buying into your own propaganda. The other example is the greatest story, was it Greatest Story Never Told or whatever? I think that 10-hour documentary. I mean, that's another good example in that it goes to the other extreme of defending pretty much everything that the historical National Socialist government in Germany did, just basically the photo negative of mainstream documentaries. So I think we can afford to be more realistic and more nuanced in our assessments rather than sort of leaping one way or the other.
Yeah, and not to, again, sound too antagonistic, but it is basically essentially a childish reaction to go, you know, I don't like X, I must believe in Y.
Yes.
You don't actually have to do that. You are allowed to have nuance. You're not a cuck for believing in, like, some levels of gray. You know, as a Christian, the only thing which is absolutely good is God. If we're talking about humans and politics and history, there is no thing which is 100% good or 100% bad, and you're allowed to have nuance and to believe in complexity.
Well, what was I going to say? My brain's been erased. Oh well. If you want to look at other examples, if you want to think about, if you're trying to sort of imitate and bring on board new ideas, there are other countries and leaders that have done similar things in a different way. I mean, Spain, for instance, is a fantastic example with Franco that no one really talks about. Everyone forgets about Spain. Why does everyone forget about Spain? Because it was run like decently well and it wasn't, you know, bombastic.
Yeah, it just kind of with anyone, didn't kill anyone.
Yeah, because it wasn't crazy and unhinged, and it just kind of did its thing and protected its own people, and everyone forgets about that. So you can always bring up Spain as a model that can sort of counteract the German narrative, for instance. But also, every time that you spend energy and time, anything that you spend on defending something that happened almost, you know, 90 years ago now, you're not looking forward and you're not working forward, and you're spending energy on something that won't give you anything in return, in my opinion. So yeah, that's my thoughts on it.
Yeah, no, fair enough, good. There are a couple of other things that stood out in the talk that you gave, Thomas. One of them was the tree trunk versus the branch idea. So the idea that, you know, nativists are only concerned about the little branch of Anglo-Celts in Australia and other people that have you know, assimilated to that from European backgrounds who've naturalized, whereas, you know, NS guys are concerned about, you know, the entire tree. And I think that's kind of, this is like the other temptation that they'll have, because there's the one hand of the super narrow focus into, you know, German history to extremely autistic levels. But then there's the other side of it where they'll sort of, it's kind of like, it's almost a Mott and Bailey thing, but they'll say, well, you know, really when I say we NS is indispensable, what I'm saying is it's just a manifestation of natural law or things along those lines, or it's just a return to Proto-Indo-European culture or Aryan culture. So, you know, it's not that I think we really need to imitate everything that the painter did, but we do have to manifest natural law and Aryan culture. So what would you have to say to that?
Yeah. There's certainly that second crowd, and I think that to a large extent they are different people. The second one tends to be more people who are who don't join groups, are very online, because it's kind of an unsociable attitude in a lot of ways. Again, what I was saying before about, you know, connecting with your ancestors versus, you know, trying to connect with someone who lived 6,000 years ago. Good luck doing that. You know, you don't know what language they spoke, or, you know, what they looked like, or really anything about their culture or where they lived, or, you know, it's just so, it's so immensely disconnected. And you can say, all right, there's natural law and blah, 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 blah. And if you're just, so let me word this another way. If you're just talking about natural law explicitly, and you're, you know, removing that from any particular people or time, well, it's basically just perennialism, which is a philosophical idea. And I don't really see how perennialism and National Socialism are intrinsically linked. The connection there seems to be very weak, if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, you might have some of that in Himmler and the Ahnenerbe, and, you know, to some extent, but even that is a very, I suppose, niche view on what perennialism is. And I think even a lot of NS guys would probably reject the full Himmler take on it.
Most would, yeah. Yeah, he was a bit of a funny bloke. And, you know, even H-Man would often not be very humoring towards some of Himmler's ideas. Obviously not entirely, because he was a relatively high up person in the NSDAP. So, but I suppose to some extent you could just say there that the NSDAP was, you know, a very political organization that had modern society wouldn't think so, but it had a very wide range of people and ideas within it. To the point where if the NS experiment managed to continue another 50 years, there's almost no telling what kind of direction it could have gone in, just because there was such a diversity of belief, and many of them quite kooky up in the upper ranks.
Yeah, I mean, even in the post-war, you have Rosenberg, writer of Myth of the 20th Century, who's imprisoned, and he's talking about how, you know, the Führer principle and things like this were basically aberrations. And, you know, in the post-war period, obviously had a very rosy view at this time of what the victors would allow Germany to do. But he was saying, you know, well, in the post-war period, we kind of need to go back to our roots, which, for those who don't know, National Socialism goes all the way back to 1903, well before H-Man joined. And he was saying we need to go back to those sort of more, not social democratic, but social democratic inspired roots, and have a more democratic version of NSDAP, where it's going to be, you know, a grand council elected, and there would be terms for the leader, and a division of powers, just like you have in the Australian constitution and so on. So it people tend to focus on that one period, and even in your talk you said 1919 and 1945, but outside of that it's a lot wider ranging as well.
Yeah, and it's sort of frozen in time as well. Have you ever noticed that sci-fi TV shows and movies will often have a sort of frozen ethnic makeup? So, you know, ones from the 60s will be, you know, 98% white. Ones from the 80s will be 95%. And then as time goes on, it just gets less and less white as time goes on, because people sort of perceive that, you know, the future will be the same as now in these sorts of ways.
Right. I see what you're getting at. Yeah, they're projecting into the future.
Yes.
Their own time. Yeah.
But in this case, you're projecting from the past, and sort of assuming that, you know, National Socialism would look like this or could have looked like this, when really we have no idea what sort of direction it was going in.
Yeah, and no, I think that is a quite interesting point. And I mean, you could say, I think Grant he says something like this, but you could say that if you look at the starting point of the Australian Labor Party and the starting point of the, you know, National Socialist ideology, started off very, very similar. So you could almost say that the Australian experience is like one direction that things could have gone in, you know, in an alternate timeline or whatever, right? But it's a sort of the same starting point, very similar ideals, but a quite different direction, different outcomes, and so on. So there is a lot within our own history, and obviously this is the nativist talking point, but there is a lot within our own history that we can draw upon without, you know, having to go overseas. And a lot of the time, going overseas, you're just going to be finding stuff that's already there, but more alien. So It is worth spending the time to dig into our own past, into our own heritage, our own culture. And it's a point that's much closer to where we're at now.
Yeah. So, Nikolai, I believe you had some questions.
Yes, I do. Ideally, how would an NS person's behavior and a nativist person's behavior differ?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So ideas are great, but for most of us, the way we live our lives is what is most important, as it's generally the only thing that you have much control over. So speaking as an ex-idealistic NATSOC, there can be a lot of overlap, but the differences that are there are significant. For example, NS types generally believe in an imminent collapse of the liberal world order. This colours their thinking immensely, and most of them don't think more than a few years into the future unless they're daydreaming about bean farming or raiding for supplies in a collapsed civilization. Nativists think decades ahead, towards a slow decline and Brazilification, but one where most of the same general rules apply. This means long-term careers and families are encouraged, and short-term distractions or things that are likely to put you away in jail are heavily discouraged. Nativists are also encouraged to be polite and non-confrontational when possible, on the basis that while many people in Australia don't belong here and should leave, they are still people and deserve some basic respect. Additionally, being impolite is unlikely to help, especially when that impoliteness turns into arrestable offences.
Okay. Second question. Are nativists hostile or not working politically with outside groups?
Hostile? No. We have worked together with other groups in the past and would be happy to do so again. The key point is, what benefit would it bring us? Inherently, every other group must have some point of difference, so some political flexibility is required. I would say that we are open to working with other groups on specific areas, and when we can see a benefit, both for our members and for nativism generally.
Okay. I think the third question is kind of already been answered, but I'll say it anyway because it's a different slice of cake. What would a bad nativist actor look like to you?
Well, this is definitely my opinion. I would say that it differs from what people would normally think, as we are not a conventionally activist sort of group. But a bad nativist actor, should one appear, would spread negativity and conflict within the ranks as much as possible. They would abuse accountability processes that exist within the group, and yet never be around if some positive work were to be done. They're unlikely to Fed post or to encourage crimes, as we don't engage in that sort of behavioural talk. But snakes in the grass can be found anywhere.
Righto, guys. We're coming up towards an hour. Are we thinking of perhaps wrapping it up?
I reckon. That goes right in time to where I need to hop off as well.
Yep. Okay. Well, in that case, to the listener, let us know in the comments what topics you'd like to hear about in the future. Or if there's a particular period or topic in Australian history you'd like us to do a show on, or even if you're really angry about something we said this time, and maybe we'll address it next time. Anyway, as always, I encourage all our supporters in the audience to make sure you like and subscribe, share our content far and wide. And if you want to reach out, you can always find us at oznatives.org. All right. Well, that's the podcast. Signing off.
The London lights are far abeam behind a bank of cloud. Along the shore the gas lights gleam, the gale is piping loud. And down the channel, groping blind, we drive her through the haze, towards the land we left behind, the grow land of never mind, and old Australian way. The narrow ways of English folk are not for such as we. bear the long accustomed yoke of staid conservancy. And all our roads are new and strange, and through our blood there runs the vagabonding love of change that drove us westward of the range and westward of the sun. The city folk go to and fro behind a prison's bars. They never feel the breezes blow and never see the stars. They never hear in blossom trees the music low and sweet of wild birds making melodies, nor catch the little laughing breeze that whispers in the weed. Our fathers came of roving stock that could not fix the bite, and we have followed field and flock since ere we learnt to ride. By miners' camp and shearing shed, in land of heat and drought, followed where our fortunes led, with fortune always on ahead, and always further out. The wind is in the barley grass, the waters are in bloom, the breezes greet us as they pass with honey sweet perfume. Parakeets go screaming by with flash of golden wing, and from the swamp the wild ducks cry their long-drawn note of revelry, rejoicing at the spring. So throw the weary pen aside and let the papers rest, for we must saddle up and ride toward the blue hill's breast. And we must travel far and fast across their rugged maze to find the spring of youth at last, and call back from the buried past the old Australia. When Clancy took the drover's track in years of long ago, he drifted to the outer back beyond the overflow. By rolling plain and rocky shelf, the stock whip in his hand, he reached at last, oh lucky us, the town of come and help yourself in rough and ready land. And if it be that you would know the tracks he used to ride, then you must saddle up and go beyond the Queensland side, beyond the reach of rule or law, to ride the long day through. In nature's homestead filled with awe, you then might see what Clancy saw, and know what Clancy.